This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Well, thank you very much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin. And I guess I recently decided that I needed to step outside my comfort zone on this podcast a little bit and put myself to the test. And today's guest, unbeknownst to him, is going to help me do that. So let me tell you a little bit about him, okay? This gentleman is a vocalist and songwriter and longtime band leader of the Blues Survivors. The New Haven, Connecticut native has produced the Blues Harmonica Blowout Tour for over 30 years, where he is a featured performer, but he also invites the likes of James Cotton, Kerry Bell, John Mayall, and Charlie Musselwhite, to name a few.
Yeah, now, I have all to be those guys are dead.
Yeah, understood. Now, I have to be honest, he's been involved with so many recorded works that I stopped counting. But what caught my eye is that he is also part of a highly successful video podcast called Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party, where he is features both interviews and live performances, including Charlie Musselwhite, Elvin Bishop, Duke Robillard, Magic Dick, Anson Funderburg, and more. Enough chatter from me. Let's get this party started. Mark Hummel, welcome to Time Signatures. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to come in and talk about your music and everything that you do. It's an honor to have you, but I want to start, if I can, with your first memories of music.
Okay. I guess my first memories would be when I was a kid. The babysitters that we had would play R&B on the radio in their cars when they'd be driving us around or at home on the record player. And so R&B and soul were the first things I heard.
Okay.
And then my parents played, you know, their music, which was more folk music and classical music. The folk music I kind of liked. The classical music really wasn't my cup of tea. That's Sonny, by the way. Here he comes. Here comes Sonny. He wants to show himself off. There he goes. All right. Little runway walk. Walk there. Yeah, I mean, it was really, you know, things like the Beatles that I first heard, and the Monkees I thought were great when I was a kid. Eventually it was really rock music in the 60s that kind of turned my crank. You know, things like Big Brother and the Holding Company, and the Jefferson Airplane, Blue Cheer, Jimi Hendrix, Cream.
Oh yeah.
All the kind of rock groups that were playing, they were playing blues songs, but, you know, in a rocked up way. And I kept like wondering who the songs were by that I really liked. And I kept seeing names like, you know, McKinley Morganfield, Muddy Waters, or Howlin' Wolf was Chester Burnett. And I'd see his name, Willie Dixon's name. And so because I kept seeing the same names on a lot of these songs, that made me want to check out who these guys were. And once I listened to guys like Muddy or Wolf or Willie Dixon, or, pretty quickly I found out about Little Walter because I picked up the harmonica when I was 14. And, Sonny Boy Williamson and guys like that. And when I heard those guys, I kind of left the others in the dust, all the rock people, because I thought these guys really have something that's different in their style, that it was much more kind of down to earth, less flash, but real soulful and real deep. There was just something about the sound of amplified blues harmonica and slide guitar that really excited me. And And I mean, I saw a lot of people really early on too. I saw B.B. King around that same time, like when I was 14, 15.
Wow.
I saw Buddy Guy and Junior Wells in 1968 at this festival. They were kind of more soul, so I didn't, they weren't doing as much blues back then. They were kind of a little slicker, almost James Brown type stuff when I first saw them. But the ones that really got me were Brownie and Sonny, who I saw, Sonny Cherry and Brownie McGee, I saw in a night, the first time I went to a nightclub and saw actual live blues in a nightclub. And then I saw James Cotton after that at the same nightclub. This was a place, it was a coffee house called the Ash Grove in Los Angeles. And then I saw Charlie Musselwhite. This was all within about a year, I saw all three acts.
Wow.
And that was probably 1971, something like that. And 71, 72. And I really, I loved it. I mean, it just, it blew me away seeing all these people, seeing those people up close. And,
yes.
You know, I saw Bobby Blue Bland, I saw Muddy Waters, I saw Jimmy Rogers, you know, when they came to L.A., because I was in Southern California at the time.
Sure.
But eventually I made my way up to the San Francisco Bay Area a couple years later, because there just wasn't the blues scene in L.A. that there was up here. And so this was where I ended up, mainly because there was so much live blues. You know, people knew who Muddy Waters was. They knew who James Cotton was. They knew who Little Walter was. They didn't know who those people were in L.A. In L.A., they knew, like, War, because he, you know, they had a harmonica. They had Lee Oscar. They knew Jake Isles, you know, with Magic Dick playing. But they didn't know, you know, these other, you know, older blues guys. And so that was kind of what motivated me to move up here, was the live music in venues here.
Yeah, I was looking at a recent interview that you did, and you talked about being drawn early in your life to the music of Jimmy Reed and Slim Harpo. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. And those were the guys I heard when the Babysitters would be playing the radio in the car.
Okay.
I heard Jimmy Reed and Slim Harpo on the radio, and it was not until years later that I heard, like, Scratch My Back and Honest I Do, and I went, oh man, I heard those when I was a kid. So it was kind of weird to hear something that much later and realize it was something I had heard 10 years before as a little kid, you know.
Sure. Well, Mark, you talked about picking up the harmonica when you were about 14. When did you really get serious with it?
Right away.
Okay.
I was serious right out the gate. And I had all these friends that were really good guitar players, and they could play all kinds of, you know, rock, blues and stuff like that. And I was a terrible guitar player. I was really awkward. So I kind of tried to play the guitar, but it's only been recently again that I've tried to play the guitar, and now I'm pretty serious about it. And I was serious in the 80s, I guess, for a minute. But really the harmonica was something I gravitated to it immediately, and I practiced literally for, you know, between 3 and 6 hours a day.
Wow.
As a kid.
That's dedication, man.
Yeah, I would like slow the records down to 16 from 33 so I could catch every little Walter nuance, and yeah, I mean, I was really serious about harmonica.
Yeah, no kidding. You talked about moving out to California, but what initially drew you out there in the first place?
To California?
Yeah.
Or Northern California?
Well, to California and then up to the Northern.
My parents moved here when I was 6 months old.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, see, I was born in New Haven, but they were in Yale Divinity School, and that was how I ended up moving out to California. My dad got a church out in L.A., and he was a minister, and he got a black church in Aliso Village, which was the projects right by the L.A. River, on the other side of downtown. And so that's how I ended up, you know, I was kind of, I had a different upbringing. I was a lone white kid in my school and church, and, you know, I went to school with Mexican Americans and black kids you know, a church.
So that was a tough time to come up, though, wasn't it?
Not really, because that was before the Watts riots. And
okay.
So my dad left right before the Watts riots, literally a month or two before.
Wow.
And so he kind of felt like things were changing, and he was my parents were very into the civil rights movement. And I was going to protests when I was a little kid, with them.
No kidding.
And so it was a very different upbringing. I mean, being the only white kid gave me a way different advantage than most white kids grew up in the suburbs, and just, they never met a black kid or a Mexican kid,
Right.
Okay,
right.
Here he comes again. He's showing
here
off.
Here comes Charlie.
Now, this is
Mark,
funny.
I want you to talk for a minute about that serendipitous moment in the 70s where you teamed up with Boogie Jake, Sonny Lane, Cool Papa Sadler, and Mississippi Johnny Waters.
Right.
Perhaps the defining period of time for you, wasn't it?
Well, it was definitely a time when I got myself in the thick of the blues scene in the Bay Area, because back in those days, there was a healthy blues scene, but it was a very underground blues scene, in the sense of that it was more in the black clubs. It really wasn't in the white clubs as much. The real big blues shows were at the Fillmore, the Winterland.
Sure.
But those
sure.
were kind of like packaged Bill Graham things. And he'd have, like maybe James Cotton and Jefferson Airplane and, somebody else, but it wasn't like strictly blues. It was thrown in with other rock acts, and that's kind of how it worked. So the actual blues being played in the clubs was mainly in black blues clubs. It really wasn't that much in white clubs. A little bit, there were places like the Keystone Berkeley or a Keystone Corners in San Francisco, a lot of blues. It wasn't just a thing. I was in club. That was kind of how I got really into the scene, was hanging around these blues clubs with the older guys. I was the young white kid that was just enamored with blues, and I was into meeting anybody that was blues. So those were the guys I met, Cool Papa was the first guy. A guy named Ron Thompson, I don't know if you know that name, but Ron Thompson was he was a really great guitar player that lived around here. And he had played with people like Little Joe Blue and Casey Douglas, who was a slide guitar player from the Central Valley. They were old guys. Later on he played with John Lee Hooker, and
wow,
he played with he backed everybody, because he was a favorite of the guy that used to put on the San Francisco Blues Festival, Tom Mazzolini. He'd hire Ron to back everybody. Like, I saw Ron one year back Big Mama Thornton, Roy Brown, Lowell Folsom, Percy Mayfield, Pee Wee Creighton. He backed all those people.
Wow.
In 1 or 2 years, because he was really a great, great backing artist. He could really play, great slide guitar, but also great lead guitar. And so he was really the first guy I met when I was walking around Berkeley one day, and he was playing on Sproul Plaza on the steps, and he was playing slide guitar, and he was playing really heavy duty Robert Johnson stuff on the slide. And so I walked up to him, and I asked him if he wanted a jam. He goes, "Hey man, you know Roller Coaster," which is a little Walter number, and I tried to play it, and then he was like, "Yeah, and I'll tell you anything you want to know," kind of thing, And so the first thing I asked him is, "Where do I hear blues? Where do I go jam with some people playing blues?" And he told me about a place called The Playboy Club, THEE.
Okay.
and that was in Richmond, and that was in a really unincorporated part of Richmond. It was a funky blues joint. It was like you were in the middle of Louisiana or something when you played there. It was chickens in the yard. It was totally different. It was totally different than what I was used to. But I went out there and I was like, me and the bass player were the only white guys in there. And I asked if I could sit in, and this guy, Cool Papa, who was hosting the jam, his real name was Haskell Sadler. And he said, yeah, come on up. And I played, and he was like, man, my harmonica player is going to be gone for the next 3 weeks. You want to play every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday with me? And I was like, in, you know, that was a big deal to me. I mean, I had a month of gigs, you know. So through him, I met, a guy, a singer named Charles Huff, who sang with him all the time. It was a great, you know, blues singer. I met, I met this bass player who ended up, he ended up joining a band called the Radiators, a guy named Reggie Scanlon. And he ended up, we ended up playing together with Sonny Rhodes for a while. And then we played with Boogie Jake for like a year. And Boogie Jake was Lil Walter's cousin, who was from the same town as Lil Walter, Marksville, Louisiana. And so, you know, that was like a thrill, you know, to meet somebody who actually was related to Lil Walter and played with him and stuff. And so we played with him. He was a real down-home, kind of almost light and slim type guitar player and singer. And we recorded 45 with him, and I recorded some 45s with Johnny Waters when I got with, that was when I started this band that I kept the name of, the Blues Survivors. That was in 1977 that we started that.
Okay.
And or actually late 76. And so that was me and a guy named Johnny Waters, who was a singer guitar player who really could do that Mississippi Chicago sound. He, you know, he played slide guitar some, he played good lead guitar. He knew who, you know, guy, he played songs by guys like Jimmy Rogers and Lil Walter and Muddy Waters. But that was really rare around here. Nobody, the blues scene here was more of a scene of guys from Texas and Louisiana. So it was much more in the T-Bone Walker, Lightnin' Hopkins, B.B. King. That was more the style that was popular here. But guys that sang Muddy Waters, that was really rare. And so I started this band called the Blues Survivors with Johnny. That's when Sonny Lane eventually came in and joined the band. He was Sonny's old buddy. I mean, Johnny's old buddy. And so they had known each other for 20 years or something. And all we did was Chicago blues. I mean, that was kind of the repertoire, was all Muddy and Lil Walter and Jimmy Rogers and, you know, that kind of thing. Magic Sam, Otis Rush. There was no one else around here really doing that. I mean, you know, you had the transplant guys like, say, Nick Gravenitis moved here, Mike Bloomfield moved here, Luther Tucker moved here. They all moved here from Chicago.
Sure.
And Charlie Musselwhite ended up here. John Lee Hooker ended up here. But they all lived in either Marin County or San Jose. And so there really wasn't anybody in the East Bay doing the kind of stuff we were doing. And we were really more of a ghetto blues band. That was kind of more what we were. We weren't slick, we weren't very polished, but we were definitely funky and you know, playing those songs. And Johnny could really sing. He could really sing Chicago blues. I mean, he could sing as good as anybody, like doing an Otis Rush or a Muddy Waters or something like that.
Now, along the way, you had several different people that joined your band, left the band, and whatnot. A lot of those people that came and joined you became household names because of it. Among them, Mike Judge, for example. Yeah, how cool Mike is that to be working with some of these? Yeah,
That was a total fluke. I mean, Mike was somebody that actually played with a friend of mine, a guy named Paul Durquette, who I still am friends with, and he was playing with Paul in the South Bay. Mm-hmm. And somehow I heard about him. I forget who I heard about it from, but I think I went and saw him play with somebody or called him up, and and he started playing upright bass with me. And Mike was a pretty good, you know, bass player. He was a very good bass player. And he ended up playing with, after he played with me for about a year and a half, we went on the road and went all over the country, went to Europe. He eventually moved out of the Bay Area and moved to New Mexico. And then at one point, Anson Funderburk called me and he goes, you know any bass players? And I said, well, I know a guy that used to play with me and he lives in New Mexico now, but he's talking about moving to Texas. So I gave Anson Funderburk Mike's number, and that was how Mike ended up playing with Anson, who was, a lot of people say Anson was the impetus for Beavis and Butthead. Because Anson had the hair that jutted out, you know, the blonde hair that jutted
out.
So, I mean, that's the story. I mean, that, you know, Mike never really confirmed who it was. He, there's a lot of different people that are supposedly the models. I've heard that the Johnny Mueller and Jay Mueller might be the, you know, I don't know who the actual impetus for Beavis and Butthead are, but I know that when he was playing with me, my guitar player at the time, a guy named Anthony Paul, told me that Mike used to just sketch in the back of the van and he'd make these funny cartoons of me. I wish I had those.
Yeah, no kidding.
Probably
no
be kidding. Worth something. But he was, you know, he was not, the weird thing is he was not somebody I would have expected to do what he did, because he was kind of very kind of dry, droll sense of humor. And he had a great sense of humor, and he did imitations. I remember that, because he used to imitate William Clark. I remember he used to do a pretty wicked William Clark imitation. I mean, he did imitations of people. So, you know, he was definitely funny, but I never would have expected him to go where he went.
Mark, I want to turn the page for a minute. For more than 30 years, you've been presenting these harmonica blowout shows. It, as I looked back through it and was reading up on some of this, I was blown away by the stories. How did the blowout come to be in the first place? And what do you credit the longevity for this to?
You know, the longevity is twofold. I mean, one of the things is I knew it was a popular kind of event that I could put on and I could do it anytime I wanted. What I kind of did with it, though, this was 33 years ago. I did the first one, 34 actually, because I started him in 1991 at a little club in Berkeley called the Ashkenaz. And the first time I did it, it was really just a one-off. It was kind of a fluke. You know, I put it on, I hired Rick Estrin to be the headliner at the time because I knew Rick real well, we were old friends. And then I got a couple other harmonica players to go on it. At the time, I had a real good band. I had Rusty Zinn on guitar. Jim Pugh was on keyboards. I forget who the bass player was. Mark Carino, I think. And Jim Overton, I think, was the drummer. So okay. I had a good little band. They could back everybody. They could play all the styles. The one thing about me is I've always had bands that could kind of cover the harmonica stuff really well. And I've had some of the best, you know, traditional players that could really play with a harp of anybody, you know, guys like Rusty Zinn, and then, you know, people like Junior Watson sometimes, or Anson Funderburk, who I play with all the time, Steve Freund, who I play with all the time, you know, a lot of great people that I've had. Sue Foley actually started with me years ago, in 1989. So I've had all kinds of people that know how to back a harmonica. So it made sense to have my band back up all these different harp players that would come in.
Sure.
And so we did this one in 1991, and it was a hit. It was like on a Sunday night, Martin Luther King holiday weekend. We had 150 people, and the promoter, the owner of the club, just said, let's do this every year. So that's how it got started. Is he had a good night, and he said, let's do it every year. So we did the first four there. Then he got murdered outside of his club.
Oh, wow.
And when he got murdered, that was a real freak thing.
Yeah.
Then I moved to another club. I think it was, there was a club called Kimball's Kimball's was a club I moved it to. They went under when they went under in 1999, I think. Then I moved it to Yoshi's, which is a really nice club in Oakland. And these were bigger clubs. They were like, you know, 300 plus seats. Sure. And by 2000, I was doing it at Yoshi's every year. And I did that up until about 2016. And then I moved it to the place I've been doing it recently, which is called the Freight and Salvage. And that's an even bigger room. That's about a 450 room. And we would do like a 2-3-4 night run. When I was doing Yoshi's, it was four nights. Then they knocked it back to three. At the Freight, it's been two because it's a larger room. And you know, it's still a successful venture that I do, and I do it all up and down the West Coast. I do it all the way from the very top of Washington all the way down to Southern California. And you know, it's usually about a, you know, anywhere between 10 days to 2 week tour that we do.
Okay.
And like this last one, I had Curtis Salgado, Nick Moss as a guitar player, Dennis Grundling as a harmonica player, a gal from Spain named Sweet Marta, that's this really nice looking great harmonica player from Spain. She's amazing. So I kind of scaled it down to like four people this last time, because then what I did, and I don't know that I'm going to do this every year, but this year what I did is I scaled it down to four, but then we had like special guests in each town.
Okay.
You know, I had RJ Michaud when we played near him as the opener. I had Kim Field up in Seattle when we played there, or Hank Shreve in Eugene, Oregon. Billy Watson in SoCal. You know, so I kind of did it where I brought in special people that were more local to be kind of the, you know, the one that'll maybe make some noise to their friends and get them out.
Okay.
I don't know that I'll do that every year. I mean, next year my plan is to have Magic Dick, Curtis Salgado, Anson Funderburg again on guitar, Steve Freund on guitar, and maybe Steve Geiger. I'm talking to Steve Geiger about playing, who's a great harp player from the East Coast. But, you know, I mean, it's generally my friends. That's kind of usually who I have, is I have people that are friends. But, you know, a lot of the old timers, unfortunately, have passed. You know, I mean,
yes.
Charlie Musselwhite's about the last one left of the, you know, well, other than, you know, Magic Dick or Lee Oscar.
Right. Yep.
Guys of that age range. But it's guys basically in their late 70s, early 80s.
You know, yes, sir.
It would be the older guard. Like Billy Boy Arnold, I've had a ton of times, but Billy Boy's 88 now. He really doesn't want to travel anymore.
Yeah. Well, Mark, back in 2012, you were part of a California-Texas aggregation called the Golden State Lone Star Review.
Right.
Among others, Little Charlie and the legendary Anson Funderburg. Talk about that tour for a moment, if you would.
Right. Well, that wasn't a tour. That was a regular band up till 2018.
Okay.
But it started in 2012. Initially, what happened was when Rusty Zinn left my band the last time, I used Little Charlie Beatty as a sub. And we had a really fun time playing together. And he had left Little Charlie and the Nightcats previous to that. And he was really kind of semi-retired, I guess you would say. He was doing gypsy jazz stuff, but not really playing blues much. And so I hired him on this gig, and we had a pretty good time playing together, doing a bunch of little Walter stuff. And then after that, we started working together. That was 2011. And so we worked together for about a year off and on, and then at one point, I was using Wes Starr on drums, who I still use. This was 2010, I started using Wes. And the bass player was a guy named R.W. Grigsby, and they were like longtime playing partners. They'd grown up together in high school. And So they were the rhythm section on a lot of my stuff. And I asked Wes one time, because he played with Anson in the Rockets, and he'd played with everybody. He'd played with, you know, Omar Dykes and Jimmy Vaughn and Asleep at the Wheel and Delbert McClinton, Marsha Ball, all these different people. Mm-hmm. And so since he played with Anson, I said, what would you think about talking to Anson about doing some gigs? And I'd known Anson, but I'd never really, other than I think I did use him on a blowout in 2002. Yeah, he did a blowout with Sam in 2002. And that was really the only time I'd worked with him, even though we'd known each other forever. And so I asked him, what would you think about, you know, talking to Anson about maybe doing something with me and Little Charlie? And so I called up Anson, and he goes, I don't think I've ever said more than about two sentences to Little Charlie in 20 years. So it was like, you know, it was like he really didn't know what to think, and even though they had played a ton of shows together. And so we tried it, and it worked magically. It worked really well. The two guitars had a great kind of contrast in styles. They ended mm-hmm. up, Charlie was real competitive at first, but then he kind of calmed down a little bit because Anson wouldn't compete with him. Anson would just play the way he plays. And so that was interesting. And then they got to be really good friends. They ended up becoming wow. really, really tight. And so we played together from 2012 to 2016, about 5 years. And then finally, you know, I think me and Charlie kind of bumped heads off and on, just because, you know, he felt like he should be an equal band leader. And I kind of maybe had it alluded that somehow we could have three band leaders, but that doesn't really work. I found that out, you know, and so Charlie kind of went his way and I went mine, and we ended up still working with Anson and Wes and RW. And we hired for a couple of years, we had Mike Keller in the band as the other guitar player. And then eventually I just kind of gave up the ghost, because the chemistry was really Charlie and Anson, I think. And they had a special chemistry going with each other, you know. So, but we did record two albums. I recorded three albums total with Charlie, because he's on the Remembering Little Walter CD that we did that was nominated for a Grammy and won a couple blues awards. He's on that. And then the one called The Hustle Is Really On is the first one we did with the band. And the second one was just the Golden State Lone Star Blues Review album.
Okay.
So we made, you know, three really good records.
Now the 2014 album project, Remembering Little Walter, that you just alluded to.
Yeah.
Not one, but two Blues Music Awards for the work, Blessed Blues CD yeah. and Blessed Traditional CD.
Right.
That really had to be a labor of love for you, was it not?
Well, it was. And, you know, that was really kind of a gift from Charlie Musselwhite, because I've known Charlie forever. And he was nice enough to do this project, because he played on a bunch of blowouts and stuff. But sure. He was really nice enough to say, yeah, I'll record this album with you. And he gave me a very fair price for it. And you know, we got the Grammy nom because of him. I'm sure of it. It had Billy Boy and it had Charlie, but I really think it was because of Charlie that we got the Grammy nomination. He ended up winning that year for the album he did with that he was playing with Ben Harper.
Okay.
He ended up winning a Grammy with Ben Harper, because so he kind of had it set up so he was going to win either way. either our nomination or the Ben Harper nomination.
Would have been fun if they would have both won, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but they don't do that.
Right.
But yeah, Charlie was very much instrumental in us winning. The other thing was Blind Pig Records, who put it out. They were able to secure a nomination with the Grammys, and I think it was because of the label help too.
Nice.
Because,
nice.
You know, I haven't really been on many labels that are standout labels. I never was on an Alligator or a Del Mark or Blacktop or anything like that. I mean, the biggest label I was on was Flying Fish Records and then Tonequel Records. And so, you know, Flying Fish was definitely a step up from those.
Sure.
And then I was on Electrify Records forever. I was on that label from 2001, I think, up until this last year.
Okay.
So, yeah. Well, so I was,
Mark,
with them for a long time.
Your 2020 project, Wayback Machine, and subsequent follow-up, Mark Hummel proudly presents East Bay Blues Vaults 76 through 88. Have
right.
really cemented your spot among the greatest bluesmen of all times. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, you definitely paid your dues, you know?
Well, I mean, I think that what I've tried to do, I wouldn't say it cemented me as one of the great bluesmen of all time, but thank you. I would say that it's, I would say that what it's done is kind of say what it is I've done. You know, it's kind of been testimony to being out there for a lot of years, working with a lot of, you know, legendary blues people over the years. I wouldn't say East Bay Blues Vaults was necessarily legendary people, except for Brownie McGee and maybe Sonny Rhodes. Some of the names on it aren't as well known. People like Ron Thompson or Johnny Waters, J.J. Malone, but they're all really valid, you know, people. I mean, they're definitely real blues people that you know, were great. And that was kind of why I put that record out, is I wanted to put something out that kind of testified to what was going on in the early 70s blues-wise in the Bay Area. There was a really good scene around here.
Yes, sir.
And the way you know that is that when you look at the scene now, there's not near the array of blues talent that you had back then, black blues talent I'm talking about, you know,
right.
people like Sonny Rhodes and Johnny Waters and J.J. Malone and Troyce Key and you know, Brownie McGee living here in the Bay, Luther Tucker living in the Bay. You know, there was a lot of talent that lived here that was, you know, really valid bona fide blues.
Sure.
And I'm very proud to have been part of that, you know, in the day, because it's gone now. You know, everyone's gone. I mean, you know, I'm one of the few guys still alive, you know,
yes,
of
sir.
that era. And you know, you got people like Rick Estrin were around at that time, and who else? Joe Louis Walker, trying to think of some others that were kind of on that scene. Ron Thompson was definitely heavily in the scene. So, you know, it just, they were valid, really valid blues people. And, you know, a lot of the names now were not around back then. I mean, Tommy Castro was really not, you know, in that scene. Chris Kane
right.
was in the scene a little bit. But really not many other people that you can talk about now that were part of it. So,
well, we also need to talk a bit for a minute about your podcast, Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, in preparing for this interview, I did watch a couple of episodes, so I kind of get a feel for the flow of your program. And I mm-hmm. like the laid back, folksy, just comfortable, musician to musician banner back and forth. I think that it really raises the bar for the program itself to be able to have the discussions that you've had with some of the musicians. Have you had any favorites along the way that you could talk about? Any favorite episodes?
Oh God, I've had a whole bunch. I mean, I've done close to 60, I think.
Okay.
And I've really covered an amazing, the swath of musicians I've covered has really been a big part of the California, you know, history of music around here. I mean, when you consider, you know, everybody from Bobby Black, who was a famous steel player, who is still a famous steel player that lives around here, played with Commander Cody for years, but started with people like George Jones and a lot of, you know, famed country guys, you know, something like him or somebody like Nick Gravenites, who was really kind of the godfather of the white Chicago blues movement that moved to California, mm-hmm. or Charlie Musselwhite, Elvin Bishop, who were also part of that, Barry yes, Goldberg, who was part of that, Boz Scaggs, I just interviewed, who was definitely part of that scene. And then I interviewed a lot of the hippie blues bands like Country Joe McDonald and Barry Melton, Dave Getz, and Peter Albin from Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Okay.
Willie Chambers from the Chambers Brothers. God, who else? Well, Magic Dick I interviewed, Lee Oscar I interviewed. Duke Robillard from Roomful and his own band, and also Greg Piccolo from Roomful of Blues, Jim Pugh, who has Little Village Foundation, John Primer, Rick Estrin, Sugar Ray Norcia, Jason Ricci, John Nemeth, Aki Kumar, Kid Anderson, Rusty Zinn, Bob Welsh, Anson, Billy Flynn.
So just a couple, right?
Oscar Wilson. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's like I got so many, it's hard to remember them.
It's
hard to remember them all because I've interviewed so many people. But, you know, the bottom line is it's all people that I've known for a long time. And that contributes to being able to interview people in a fairly yes. relaxed way. It's not yep. people that I, you know, I mean, interviewing Boz was a little intimidating, even though I've known him for a long time. I've never sat down and really done an interview with him. So, but frankly, he was so relaxed and so open that it was a very easy interview. And it was actually our second one, because I had tried to interview him in San Francisco and it was this noisy environment and I couldn't even use it, and he was kind enough to let me do a second run at it a month later. So, you know, I mean, a lot of it is just you know, interviewing people that I've known for a long time, that I felt comfortable with.
Yes, sir.
I try to really do my homework when I do these things. I don't go in not knowing who I'm interviewing, and that to me is, that's 90%. It's like, you know, you actually did some checking up on, you know, who I've worked with and stuff like that, what I've accomplished. I mean, that's so important when you're doing interviews, because if you don't know who you're interviewing, I mean, I've done things like, there used to be the House of Blues interviews. I know I'm slagging on them for a minute, but I mean, the first time they did a great job. The second and third times it was so bad, I walked out. You know, they set me up with an intern one time, and the guy was literally reading off the screen when I got there, reading my bio. And it's like, wow. You know, you don't do that. You just don't do that. So, you know, it's really important that if you're interviewing somebody, you know who you're interviewing and you have background on the person so that you can ask an intelligent question.
Right.
You know, one of my favorites is Terry Gross, on NPR. And to me, she is the ultimate interviewer because she will really do her homework, you know. And
yeah, we had a gentleman up here by the name of JP McCarthy in Detroit that was just such a comfortable, natural interviewer. I mean, if there was yeah. anybody that I would aspire to be, it would be somebody like him. But of course, you yeah. know, it takes time. It takes time. And as I said at the beginning of
yeah,
the program,
you learn as you keep going. And the yep. other thing is I got more and more aware of what to do and what not to do. I did one with Chris Layton, the guy from Stevie Ray's band, the mm-hmm. drummer, in And man, I did that on the blues. I did that interview on the Blues Cruise. I did about five interviews on the Blues Cruise. I think I did wow. Tommy Castro, Jontavious Willis, Daryl Davis, who's a fascinating story, Fillmore Slim, and then I did this one with Chris Layton. And when I did the Chris Layton one, it got all this traction. I was kind of blown away. Within like 2 days, it had like 6,000 views or something, and I was like,
wow,
damn, you know. But one of the things that happened is these people would come on and they were only Stevie Ray freaks. They didn't know who the hell I was, and they would be going, why is this guy always interrupting him, you know, and stuff like this. So, you know, it kind of made me really aware of, if people don't know who you are, they're going to take you to task if they don't like the questions you're asking. Or, you know, I mean, one of the things I try to do is I try not to interrupt, but sometimes I want to steer the conversation in a certain direction.
Yes.
And one of the things I've found about interviewing is when you're dealing with older people that are my age and up, that somebody like Barbara Dane, for example, she died last year at 98. I interviewed her when she was 96.
Wow.
And she was one of the most amazing interviews I've ever done. And she's somebody I've known for 45 years. So I knew all this information about her. But because she was 96, and this is Barbara, this is just the way she was, she had a tendency to go off on tangents when you'd ask a question. And okay. You kind of have to reel her back in. And the only way you reel somebody back in if they're going off on a tangent is to go, what about this or what about that? That's how you reel them back in. And it means you have to sometimes interrupt.
Yeah.
But,
yep.
You know, so what? It's better to do that than have somebody talk for 10 minutes about 16 different things.
Well, and one of the things that I'm proud of with Time Signatures is we are the only currently produced podcast that's housed on the Blues Archive at the University of Mississippi. So oh, when cool. I sit down and I get to talk to somebody like yourself with a huge background, I like to let you guys run a little bit because it lets me capture some of those stories.
Right.
You know, and it's important to let the interviewee talk and
right.
and get their information out there, you know?
Yeah.
Which brings me to my next question for you, because we could talk all night about this stuff. I mean, I'm very much enjoying the conversation, but I'd like you to bring us up to speed on what's going on with you currently. It looks like you have a busy touring schedule for this year, and I assume True Believer is still front and center.
Yes.
Anything on the back burners for a new album or anytime soon, or
yeah,
what's going
actually, on? Actually, I just finished doing a record. I mean, I'm kind of relentless about recording. I'll put out a record pretty much every 2 years. And I already put together something that's it's really kind of a composite of different sessions that hadn't been released. So it's kind of like, I guess I would say it's it's things from Golden State that never got released. It's things from True Believer that never got released. It's things from some of my really old records like Retroactive from 2007. And it's really a mishmash of songs, but I was able to make it fairly cohesive. And this thing's an all-star recording. I mean, I've got, you know, the guitar lineup just in itself is amazing. I've got little Charlie Beatty, I've got Anson Funderburg, I've got Junior Watson, I've got Kid Anderson, I've got Rusty Zinn, I got Mike Keller, you know, Bob Welsh. I mean, all these different people on it. And then I got, you know, Wes Starr on a whole bunch of the drum tracks and R.W. Grigsby on a bunch. So, you know, I mean, it's really one of those things where you have to, if you're going to put together a record, you have to find a way to make this thing sound cohesive.
Sure.
And I felt like I was able to do that with these recordings. And it's got about, I'd say, 6 originals and then, you know, it's like, I think 15 cuts. So got about 6 originals and 9 covers. But one of the things I try to make a point of doing, and True Believer is an example of this. True Believer, I think I had 7 originals and the rest was covers. But I try to kind of come up with originals that sound within the genre I'm doing. In other words, they fit into that kind of electric Chicago blues or West Coast swing blues type of thing. And so that's kind of generally how I write, is I write stuff that's maybe got a Jimmy Reed groove, or it's got kind of a, I have one called Ghosted that I almost came up with sort of a Wang Dang Doodle type of guitar line in it, or, and that was really Billy Flynn came up with the guitar line. He came up with that part. But I had an idea on the beat, I had an idea on the melody, and that's kind of how it works. I mean, the funny thing was when the pandemic hit, it was a really interesting time, because the pandemic was a time when I put a lot of effort into writing new songs, working on my guitar playing again, working on racked harmonica and guitar, learning pre-war styles of harmonica. Like I worked on playing like Sonny Terry, who I'd never tried to tackle before, or Jazz Gillum is another guy. On the Wayback Machine, I did some Jazz Gillum stuff. I mean, more acoustic styles of harmonica that weren't as Chicago heavy amplified playing. And so that was kind of where I put a lot of my efforts, was learning those. And then these songs, and I worked on all these songs, and a lot of the songs were songs that I had kind of fooled around with, but never really fully put them all together. And I worked on some of these with R.W. Grigsby. He helped me with some, and then I just, you know, I just kind of put them together and made them functional, where they were just kind of loose notes before. And sometimes you do that, you start a bunch of songs and you end up like taking this line from this song and this line from this song, putting them together. But I wrote a lot of political stuff on this record too. And that was a result of everything that was going on.
I was going to say, it seems like there's a lot of writers, a lot of musicians in the blues world today that have done a lot of different political left, right. However, you see a lot of different stuff coming out. Shut Up and Play by Taranzo is a great example of that.
Right. Yeah. There's one we wrote called High Time for the Devil, me and my friend Phil Marsh wrote. And I really felt like that song came together well. And it's kind of creepy because it ended up being truer than when we wrote it. You know, by the
That's
time.
That's scary.
Yeah, it really is. It is scary. You know, we had another one, I recorded Elvin Bishop's What the Hell, you know?
Yep.
Which is a great song. Elvin's such a great writer. You know, so I mean, you know, Ghosted was very topical. Little Electric Car, I kind of dedicate to Elon Musk every night that he didn't use it, you know? But, you know, I just, Jackknife was another one that RW had written a while back, and I helped him with some, and that's one we've been doing, God, since 2018, I think we've been doing that song. And that's actually gotten some serious XM airplay, which is nice.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, here's the most important part of this interview. Where can people go to find out more about Mark Hummel, maybe buy some CDs, some merchandise, or maybe even book you for a gig?
Yeah, the best thing to do is go to my website, markhummel.com. H-U-M-M-E-L is how my last name is spelled. And the podcast, if anyone's interested in that, that's called Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party. And I also have an album called Harmonica Party, so it can confuse people. But if you see Harmonica Party by Mark Hummel, right under it, you'll see Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party.
That has
all, God, I think it's got like 130 or 140 clips on there between live music clips and the interviews. But my friend Jeff Vargin is the guy that really got me started on that. He produces these videos and edits them down, and he's done a really, really fine job of making them look good.
Very cool. Well, Mark Hummel, it has been a pleasure, my friend. Thank you so much for taking time today to be with me on Time Signatures. All the best to you, and you got your tour starting tomorrow, of all things. So
yes, I'm starting
safe
tomorrow.
Travels.
Tomorrow we're in Fresno. Friday the 2nd, Fresno to May, we're in San Francisco, and then the 3rd we're in Fort Bragg, and then we go to the East Coast. We fly to the East Coast on Monday, and we'll be out there for like a little over 2 weeks. So all over the Northeast. And then we're going to Europe twice this year, both Scandinavia and then the mainland part of Europe in October, late October, all over at that point. So
very cool.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up here, I would like to remind you that it takes an estimated 5,000 music streams to raise the equivalent of a $20 CD purchase. I couldn't believe that, but I have made it my policy, and believe me, I put my money where my mouth is, to buy music from the artist first, and then and only then I will avail myself to streaming their music on various platforms. I mean, if we want their live music out there, we owe it to ourselves and these musicians, especially musicians like Mark that's just getting ready to go on the road, to spend some of our hard-earned cash on supporting the music that they produce and their merchandise. Trust me, the money goes directly into their pockets, and they're going to thank you every single time. And as always, thank you for your consideration, folks. And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my appreciation and thanks to Mark Hummel, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you that keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm good. Up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.